From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, April the 7th, 2020, and most of our discussions today, once again, will revolve around the coronavirus crisis, and we are still facing weeks to go, it appears, of much upheaval and upset and uncertainty and worry and probably some more people getting sick and even some more people dying here in the state of Vermont, as well, of course, as nationwide and worldwide. We are going to be talking first this morning with Katie Jickling. She's healthcare writer with VTDigger.org, and a little bit later in this hour, I'll be speaking with Eric Ford. He's with the Vermont PBS statewide television, public television network, and he's going to be talking to us about a new partnership between PBS and the state of Vermont to try to deliver some educational services to our young folks who, of course, have been out of school for weeks now, and there's a lot of concern about whether they can get some educational value out of these last, what were going to be the last 2-3 months of the school year. And now there's concern about whether they can merely kind of stay in place educationally and not lose ground on things like reading and math and other skills that you you usually build in a gradual way throughout your school year and school years. But and then later on in the program, Mike Smith's going to be my guest. Of course, he's a former host of this show, but more importantly these days, he is actually a Vermont's Secretary of Human Services, and we've had a couple of more positive test results, staffers in the Northwest Vermont Correctional Facility and other big impacts in our human services system from the coronavirus outbreak, and we're going to be speaking with Secretary Smith about that and about the state's various responses to these issues. And so goodful and I hope informative show today. As always, we welcome calls from our listeners, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255, the latter, of course, our toll-free number. And I want to introduce our first guest, who is, as I mentioned, Katie Jickling. She is with VTDigger.org. And good morning, Katie. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Good to be here.
And we, of course, are not really here. We're there. We are doing all this remotely, I gather. You are at your home right now, and I am too, and we have, thank heavens for our communications technology, we can still pull all of this together. And so I wanted to start out by asking you, what do you think the overall shape of this thing now? Are we starting to see maybe some glimmers of hope of sort of flattening the curve here in Vermont?
Early indications do show that, Vermonters' efforts to stay at home have been working. The numbers are still going up, but for instance, the amount of time it takes for the number of cases to double has slowed, meaning that the overall growth is slower, and it does show that we're flattening the curve. But we really don't know when the number of cases will start to go down. The current estimate is, I've heard, is right around April 20th, 21st, something around there. But some mm-hmm. people say it could be as soon as a week. Some people say it could be into May. And really, even once you hit that peak of the curve, it won't be until you have we have very few or no cases that, you know, we'll be able to be out and about as normal again, just because it can so easily start to spread again.
Yeah, and of course, some other technique to prevent it spread. I mean, people talk about a vaccine, but a vaccine is said to be a year or a year and a half away in terms of any widespread availability. So, meanwhile, other people are talking up a variety of treatments and maybe cures or ways to attack this. And one is this a sort of a drug cocktail involving hydroxychloroquine. And I'm curious to know what you're hearing from Vermont. You attend the briefings with Dr. Levine and other Vermont health officials. Is anybody enthused about this, or are most people saying that it's not really a thing?
Well, I think when people are sick people are willing to try most anything, you know, and sometimes patients will sign up. They have started offering it in different places at some points, but nobody is confident that it's a cure-all. And so officials, you know, give it sort of a hesitant vote of approval, but really the best way to address this is to not get it at all and to stay home. And so there are risks that, you know, you don't want people taking some of these drugs preemptively before they have the disease, because they can have side effects, and we don't actually know that they work yet. So even there may be a slow rollout, and you know, insurers are talking about whether to cover it, all that kind of thing, but there's not... Nobody's saying anything to inspire a whole lot of confidence that this is going to be a miracle drug.
Yeah, and I'm understanding that another problem connected with it is that a run on a hydroxychloroquine type drug will actually deny it, or could have that effect of denying it to patients who have been on it for a while. And here we're talking about a lot of people with sort of chronic health problems of their own, even pre-coronavirus. I mean, rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases and so on that have been treated traditionally and with some, you know, high degree of efficacy with this particular drug, these patients would all of a sudden have a harder time getting it. I'm understanding that there's been a run on pharmacies who have stocked this, and that it's actually hard to find in a lot of parts of Vermont these days.
Yes, that is true, and as I said, that they are, you know, officials are still warning about it and telling people to slow down on that front, use caution, and the USDA has not, you know, approved these things yet. So approved these drugs for this use yet, I should say.
Yeah. And so I mean, basically here's the trade-off is that folks are trying this drug with unknown at best usefulness in terms of its ability to treat COVID-19, and meanwhile it's creating some real ripple effects elsewhere in the healthcare system that can be damaging to people who have been taking prescribed these drugs for some time by their physicians, or people maybe getting newly prescribed because they've only recently been diagnosed with some disorder that actually is well treated with hydroxychloroquine. So, you know, I think that ought to be on people's minds as well. So anyway, I wanted to also focus on some other happenings, goings on related to the COVID-19 outbreak. And I've got to say, I've done this before with your colleagues at VT Digger when I have them on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And one of the things I've been pointing out here to folks is that VT Digger has been doing just a bang-up, thorough job of covering so many different angles of the coronavirus crisis here in Vermont. And I mean, VT Digger provides just really, really thorough and dense coverage of the State House and other news happenings in Vermont as a matter of routine almost. But these days, with a lot of the focus on coronavirus, it's just very interesting to me. For instance, Alan Keyes, who is your reporter on criminal justice, the legal system, the courts, etc., he has a story today, very important story. The headline is Swanton Prison in Lockdown After Two More Staffers Test Positive for COVID-19. And so you can see where, you know, you have a criminal justice reporter who routinely covers happenings in Vermont's correction system in its prisons, And here we have an impact of the coronavirus in the corrections system. And so let's turn our criminal justice reporter onto that story. And in many other instances, you know, I've seen the person who heads up your business cover, Jan Wallace Allen, digging in on its impacts on business. So, I mean, this pandemic is affecting pretty much every part of Vermont life. And because VT Digger has these pre-existing beats and reporters who are well-versed in the subject areas they're covering, you are able to really dig in, and I just think that's very helpful for Vermont's news consumers to enable folks to keep up with stuff. And kudos to VT Digger on all that. Folks, check it out. I mean, it's online. It's a free website, vtdigger.org. If you haven't yet, though, make a donation, because like a lot of other media outlets in Vermont, I'm understanding that vtdigger.org has seen a pretty significant drop off in its revenues in the last few weeks, and really, you know, this kind of reporting doesn't get done for free. Nobody's making a lot of money there, but they do have to pay reporters in order to keep them, eating and getting to the stories and so on and so forth. And it's a labor intensive enterprise, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And and of course you, Katie Jickling, you are my guest on this first half hour of the Dave Graham Show. Being the healthcare writer at VTDigger.org, I mean, you have certainly a very central role here in the coverage that has been unfolding. And let's see, what one thing that I'm noticing is a story that talks about how nurses unions are asking Governor Scott to step it up on getting more protective gear. Is that something that is really becoming a worry in Vermont?
Yeah, so I think the impacts of COVID-19 on the healthcare system have been really quite fascinating and in some cases kind of alarming. In terms of personal protective equipment, which is the masks and the gowns and goggles and everything else, gloves that nurses and healthcare workers need to be wearing when they're caring for COVID patients, nurses are asking for more. The state has put out an order for 2.7 million pieces of personal protective gear, which sounds like a lot, but when you're changing, you know, you have to change them every few patients or every day, depending on the type of equipment. So you go through them fast, and they're really central to keeping healthcare workers safe. And so they have requested more. They say, you know, we're not running out quite yet, but we're starting to ration them in some hospitals. Some places don't have certain sizes of masks that fit nurses, for instance. Some places are having, you know, I think at UVM Medical Center, a nurse told me they're having them wear the face shields for, you know, three or five days on end. And by the time, at the end of that period, you know, they keep wiping it off and it's just all fogged up. It's really hard to see out of it. So yeah. I think hospitals, Vermont's ordering is, you know, they say, officials say they're on the phone with folks from Connecticut and people all over the country and around the world trying to get this stuff. But we don't know how much we're going to use because we don't know how many patients there are going to be. And hospitals don't want to be in the position of places in like Seattle or New York City where they really ran low.
Yeah, right. To the point where people were, you know, these repeated uses of the same gear that's really, in the normal course of events, I look at the healthcare system and just marvel sometimes at really what is just a lot of waste. I mean, it's sort of understandable why, for sanitation purposes, you would want to be, changing out your gear an awful lot. But boy, hospitals throw away an awful lot of stuff, too. In the normal course of events here, We've swung maybe too far in the other direction where people, all these repeated uses of the same masks or the same gloves, or, you know, just wash your hands with your gloves on and hope that takes care of, you know, you're reusing these gloves now for the third or fourth patient or whatever. I don't think Vermont's hospitals have gotten to that level. Is that right?
That is true, but different doctors and hospitals and clinics, offices all have different amounts of different things, and they all have different projections and different number of patients. So how they're allocating those resources varies a lot based on the place.
I still don't really have a clear picture in my mind in terms of. The metaphor I think of here, maybe it's because I grew up near the ocean, but I think of a wave approaching, and it's a big wave, and there are maybe some houses along the shore or something, but there's also a seawall. And the question, obviously, the basic physics here is the seawall tall enough and strong enough to withstand the wave and keep it from crossing the road and flooding the houses, right? And so I don't really have a handle on how high the seawall is in terms of Vermont's healthcare system's preparedness versus how high the wave is going to be, which are the projected cases. Do you have a sense of that?
I think one of the things that, in terms of preparedness, that has been striking to me is the financial impact that the coronavirus has had on hospitals. Hospitals across the state are canceling their elective procedures, canceling the annual, you know, primary care visits, and telling patients that, you know, if you don't need to come into the doctor's office, then don't, because we don't want you to inadvertently be exposed to COVID-19.
And that we don't want you to bring COVID-19 to your appointment either.
That too, yes.
Yeah.
To protect both the doctors and the patients.
Mm-hmm.
That has had a tremendous financial impact on hospitals around the state. Some have lost as much as 70% of their revenue. It's also dealt a huge blow to independent doctors and sort of the small family practices around the state. I spoke to a handful of doctors this week, and they said, you know, if we don't get the federal aid that we need, if we don't get some loans and some just cash to keep our doors open, then we're going to go bankrupt. And so that long-term impact, I think, is something that is worth paying attention to. And we're really going to see how financially strong our healthcare system is through this and how they can rebound. Already, Vermont regulators are looking at, okay, how can we make sure our hospitals stay afloat through this crisis, because they may not, you know, if this lasts several more months, they may not have the revenue and normal income to sustain this work.
Well, I remember seeing a story, but I think by you several weeks ago, before we maybe it was very early stages of the COVID-19. I don't remember the exact date, but the story essentially was saying that. Several Vermont hospitals had lost money last year, and you look at a case like Springfield Hospital, which is, you know, been teetering on the brink of collapse. It wasn't a pretty picture before, was it?
Yeah, already Vermont small hospitals and small hospitals around the country have been struggling with the declining population and just the changing environment. It's hard to hire staff. It's hard to get the sort of have a steady source of revenue. And so something like the coronavirus, really, they don't have much financial room to work already. And then you just have something that first is completely wiping out, you know, having no patients in some departments, and then in others they're, you know, really expecting, you know, they may not have a lot yet, but they're expecting a lot. Already, even at the biggest hospital in the state, the University of Vermont Medical Center, they have been laying off some staff and workers, having them take vacation time or be furloughed, and then also shuffling others so that they're, you know, everybody has work to do and, you know, to also save money as well in that there.
Yeah, that, I mean, the other thing that strikes me as sad about this, as somebody who needed a certain kind of surgeries several years ago and had to wait a long time to schedule it and get it and et cetera, I can imagine somebody who's had chronic back pain for a couple of years or whose knees need, who needs a knee replacement, and it's finally after, a couple of years of pain, increasing pain and difficulty walking and so on, was making a decision around the turn of this year of, this is the 2020 is the year in which I'm going to finally get my knee replacement or whatever. Now they're basically out of the game for some undetermined amount of time, right?
Yes. And that once again is part of the effort to keep patients out and who don't immediately need the surgery or who, might be exposed in the process, and also to protect doctors. And
yeah.
So I think what we are going to see, that's another thing that we're hearing, is because of those delays, after this crisis is over, there might be a huge influx of patients who have been putting off those surgeries and appointments and are now coming into the system and able to get them. And so doctors might be, or I think are expecting to be very busy after this, but it's a question of whether they can financially sustain themselves until that point.
Yeah, this is a tough hit on this system. It's a tough hit on everybody, on individuals, obviously. Just on these patients, I didn't want to sort of have this whole conversation without sort of just reaching out at least rhetorically and saying, hey, I know a lot of folks out there are in tough straits that way, and I, hang in there is all I can really tell you. I hope that you can get the care you need soon, sooner rather than later. It's not looking supremely good right now, and that's the problem. Is it just seems like that some of the problems that already existed in the healthcare system before the COVID-19 came around have been pretty severely exacerbated right now. And the hospitals aren't getting the income they would normally get from, the very, very busy any surgical center or surgical suites that are doing, back surgeries and knee surgeries and fixing long-term chronic shoulder pain and all the rest of it are not getting that revenue, which I would gather. I mean, a lot of those elective surgeries are fairly profitable for hospitals, aren't they?
Yes, and that's a large part of why they're seeing this financial hit, because of those lucrative surgeries and physical therapy and all that kind of stuff. Some places are, they are keeping some rooms open or some sections of the hospital open for non-COVID patients. And so they are getting the people in, who they're not turning away people with heart attacks, shall we say.
Obviously.
But it is a balancing act, and it is going to be changing it's going to change our healthcare landscape far beyond just this few months.
What do you think I don't know how clear you feel like your crystal ball is right now, Katie Jickling, but I'm wondering if you can say, okay, it's 2023, we've sort of finally had the all clear on the COVID sometime in, later in 2020. Now roll the clock ahead 3 years. What lingering impacts on, say, a UVMMC or anywhere else in the Vermont healthcare system will there be from this whole chapter?
That's a good question. I think that one thing that we're seeing is doctors are moving to telemedicine. and have started seeing patients by phone or by video call. And that's for even for, you know, older doctors who maybe hadn't used it before or weren't comfortable with it. And so I think we may see a broader shift to telemedicine among among doctors and patients of all kinds. I think that will, you know, for the older person who doesn't want to go to the doctor's office when it's 15 below in a year or two, that might be the way that they can still, you know, get screened or get whatever issue they have checked up on. And I think that it's really going to test some of our underlying healthcare infrastructure. You know, we have this all-payer system that changes the way that doctors are paid. And so I think right now that's basically on hold because the regulators and state officials want all the available money going to prop up hospitals in this time. And so basically the rollout of some of those larger systems are going to have to wait for a while.
Katie Jickling, I'm about out of time on this segment, but I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Katie is the healthcare writer with vtdigger.org and always informative and knowledgeable about this topic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Alrighty, we're going to go to a bottom of the hour news break, some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and when we return, we'll be talking with Eric Ford of Vermont Public Television. We'll be back.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Continuing into the second half hour of our program on this Tuesday, April the 7th, 2020. One of the big shakeup areas of the response to COVID-19 and the pandemic has been in the educational realm here in Vermont. Of course, all of our schools have been closed since about mid-March per order of the governor. Just last week, the governor extended the time of that order right through the end of this semester in spring semester of 2020. And that's really thrown Vermont's educational system into a bit of a tailspin here, I think, is the one way to describe it. But folks are trying to figure out how can we deliver education to our kids, even when our kids can't be delivered to schools by parents dropping them off or school buses or anything else because the schools are closed. And one interesting announcement came out yesterday, which was that Vermont PBS, the public television system that serves the state of Vermont, announced a collaboration with state officials and educational officials to help to fill in the gaps of our young folks' education. And joining me in this second half hour is Eric Ford. He is director of programming at Vermont PBS, and he is, of course, deeply involved in this effort to try to help out with Vermont's educational system in this time of crisis. And I believe Eric Ford is on the phone with me. Sir, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Vermont PBS, of course, is another one of these. You guys may be the grandparent of all the nonprofit media out there. We, of course, have VPR, and I talk a lot about Vermont Digger on the Dave Graham Show because, for instance, just the last half hour we had Katie Jickling on from Digger, I think they are doing a lot of great stuff on just the daily journalism front. But the original nonprofit media outlet in the state of Vermont was, I think, back in the day it was called ETV, as in educational television. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We fun fact, we actually began as a television organization before PBS. We started about a year before PBS even existed. So started out back in the day, I would say 53 years ago, I think my math is correct, as part of the University of Vermont, and started as educational television, doing exactly that. I had the pleasure when I first started a few years ago of working on programming for the 50th anniversary, and we created a program using archival footage, so transferring film footage from way back 50 years ago, and actually watched footage of Vermont PBS, or at that time ETV, going into schools and attaching antennas to the roof and putting televisions in classrooms for educational content directly for students in Vermont. So it's really, right now, I'm really excited because it's a direct return to that kind of service.
Yeah, and I'm old enough that I remember probably being the student in a classroom like that where, you know, the TVs were starting to be rolled in for the first time, and it was sort of something special. Is okay, now we're going to watch this program from public television, you know, whatever, history, or I still remember French classes. And yeah. Probably when I was in fifth or sixth grade or something, and they were being delivered by, you know, and the teacher would set up the black and white TV on the rolling cart at the front of the room.
Yeah,
and I'd say, écoutez et répétez. So,
yeah.
So, obviously, PBS has taken on a much broader and different, really, flavor in the subsequent 50 years. People probably don't think first about that really kind of nitty gritty educational stuff when they're watching Downton Abbey or something,
right.
But or one of the nature shows. But nature shows maybe a little more. But I just wonder how this sort of fits in with the overall programming. It's not gonna really change any of your hit shows or news programs or anything like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of different entry points. I think as kids, a lot of folks have definitely, kids and families, tuned in over the years to the wealth of children's programming. So that's something that, you know, has always continued throughout several decades, that commitment to education and learning for all ages, you know, mostly focused on young kids. So that's always been present, and folks may not know that we actually have four broadcast channels. They're all available for free over the air, which is another great thing about this idea is talking about access and equity. And, you know, this is just like radio. Local television is something that's available with not a lot of access, you know, and again, that's a challenge in the state, too. But we've had a wealth of programs. We actually have an entire 24/7 kids channel that launched a few years ago. But in addition to that, on our main channel, which most people are familiar with, we've had 7.5 hours a day of kids programming throughout the day, Monday through Friday, and even on the weekends, on Sunday. So, yeah, so the shift that we're talking about to support students directly is during the daytime. So those popular evening programs that you love at night will still be in place for those folks that enjoy them. And in fact, you know, what this new schedule represents is actually repurposing a lot of those great programs, which are educational for all ages, and just connecting them directly with different activities and things for teachers to support, you know, great shows like Nature and Nova, American Experience, those kind of things that are perfect for middle and high school students.
Yeah, they definitely do have some educational content, and usually delivered in such a well-produced way that it's like, you know, your medicine wrapped in sugar or something, because they're very easy on the eyes and the ears, and they are. I mean, I remember that National Park series that you folks ran several years ago, which was just great history, and you know, it was just brilliant stuff, and it made it you know, it certainly served a huge educational purpose about that effort of our national government to do such great work in land preservation and making making our most beautiful natural areas available to people. Eric Ford is my guest on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. He's program director with Vermont PBS. And Eric, tell us a little bit about the sort of the nuts and the bolts of what the collaboration will look like with the Vermont's educational system. By the way, folks, I will tell you, it was short notice, so we weren't able to work it out, but I was trying to push to get Dan French, the Secretary of Education, on our air today. His folks told me he may be available in the coming days, but it couldn't work out for this morning, and I thought the two of you would make a great team to get into this part of it, but I'll ask you to fly solo here a bit, Eric, and tell us, will PBS be producing new programming now that's specifically geared to, I don't know, take the place of a math class or a French class or something in our public schools?
Yeah, well, you can imagine that, you know, we are an essential business, but it's been challenging navigating for us as well as all the parents and everyone out there working remotely, working with reduced staffing. So what we're talking about is really a programming shift, so not creating new content, but leveraging all the amazing content that's out there. Just to kind of start at the beginning, how this got going, it seems like years ago, but it was just a few weeks ago. What we've noticed in the PBS system, and that's the great thing about PBS, it's not like coming from upon high. Every station has their own independent way that they work, but we work together as a system. And so what we saw coming out of California, PBS SoCal, and KCET in Southern California actually worked directly with the Los Angeles district, which is the second largest school district in the country, to start developing a curriculum. So essentially, what we're doing is they're working on the programming end, and we're using that programming on our main channel. And what they've done, not to get too technical, is they've cleared all those programs for use, made them available, and then connected them to learning assets. So we have this whole wealth of stuff all of the time from PBS Learning Media, where you can actually go in and say you watch a specific NOVA program. You can connect that to lesson plans, activities, short videos, and different things. So we were very easily able to kind of make those connections, put together a schedule, and the folks in California shared that out to the rest of the system to use. So that was kind of the start. In addition to that, so that's on our main channel. We have programming from there that's also being customized for Vermont. So that's where the partnership with the Agency of Education has been so vital and so important. We knew from the start that we wanted to work together on this because we didn't want to just put something out there that people might use. We wanted to provide something for teachers and for parents so that they could incorporate it into their learning curriculum. So it's not just out there and you watch TV. So it was really important for us to work directly with the agency to get this information in teachers' hands so that they could give it out to the students in the best way that works for their schools. So that was really the wonderful part of this. So, you know, we've got two broadcast channels, actually, with different programming. On our main channel, as I was saying, it kind of stemmed out of the California programming and curriculum that was provided. So from 7 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, we've got programming and activities for grades pre-K all the way to grades 8. And then on our Plus channel, so as I mentioned, we have four different broadcast channels. Our Plus channel, which is available over the air and on cable systems, it's available in about 85 to 90% of the state. On that channel, we have programming that's coming from WGBH in Boston, which is another great partnership. Most folks are familiar with them. They're one of the biggest stations, and they're right down the road, and it's fantastic to have them as a resource. And so from 12 to 5, on our Plus channel, we have programming for grades 6 through 12. And all of this kind of rolls up into a web page that we've created on our website. It's a special at-home learning page. And actually, rather than saying the URL, if you go to the Vermont PBS website, vermontpbs.org, and just click on the top for at-home learning, you'll see every week you'll have all of the schedule grids, so you know what programs are there. and all of the connections, literal connections, to the learning programs on PBS Learning Media, so that kids can watch, you know, watch a program and then do activities. And all of this will hopefully help teachers to put together curriculums, because we know how difficult it is to try and make this happen in the midst of everyone at home and different access. You know, that's another huge piece of this, is in Vermont, who has internet access, who has access to cable or all but even cell service. It's a challenge in this little state for sure.
Yeah, the and it's very clear instructions. I'm just looking at the webpage now, which is linked from the homepage of the Vermont PBS. If you go to the link that talks about at-home learning, it really is, there's a little explanation of how it works, how to get started, you know, the step-by-step of how to get the programming in that's being lined up here for young folks. And I'm wondering about the and this is probably something I would have asked Dan French and maybe will still if I can get him on the air in the coming days, but what participation or feedback from Vermont educators did you folks receive in terms of getting all of this lining up? What, you know, are you hearing back from teachers, you know, this is something that's really needed and will fit with my program? Or are you deciding to jettison some stuff if they're saying, nah, that doesn't really fit the program? Or, I mean, has there been much give and take like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Right from a couple weeks ago, we started having regular meetings, myself and Heather Duhamel on my team, who is an amazing educator and kind of an expert in digital learning media. And so we're so lucky to have her as a connector as we navigate this. But right from the beginning, the folks at the agency have been so supportive of this idea. They've embraced it. And what we're doing and what we hope to do, again, it's early days. We just launched yesterday on both channels. And this service will be available, you know, right through the end of school, in mid-June, when school ends. And so we're hoping to continue to work together to make this effective and work well for districts and teachers in the state. So one of the first things that we did this weekend is we're working with the agency to get teachers directly connected to PBS Learning Media by creating accounts. And then they can start to see what's available there and customize it for their own learning plans. That's the thing. Everybody has, you know, not only does every individual have a different way of learning, every school and teacher and district all has different ways that they meet the educational standards that we're trying to meet in the state. And so we've had a lot of back and forth. I'm sure in the coming days, you know, in the coming weeks, we'll get direct feedback. And our goal is to make this as useful as possible. And so what we will do is absolutely customize. We've already talked about different programs in different ways that we can customize and tweak the schedule so that it works for people. So that's really our hope by working directly with the agency. And what we hope to do each week is provide this information earlier than you'd see it on our website for the teachers so that they can incorporate it into their lesson plans. Because it is, you know, as a viewer or a student or a parent, you can go right to our webpage. You can get the schedules. You can find the activities yourself. But what we're also hoping is that teachers can individualize and customize this opportunity so that it'll work best for every student. You know, hopefully, you know, not everyone has internet access. Not everyone has access, and so that's why we'll be trying to work with districts and teachers to say, you know, what is it that you need? Do we need to create packets of information that go home with students? Can folks, you know, follow direct links? A lot of folks are using Google Classroom. And just like all of us who are working remotely, everyone's using, you know, different tools like Zoom or Microsoft Teams to try and connect virtually. And it's so challenging. It's such a challenge. You know, in this little state, we know all the issues with broadband and connectivity, you know, not to mention just you know, trying to work and be a at-home teacher and all of those things all at once.
A lot of teachers are still trying to run classes virtually and give kids some assignments and so on, and keep up some semblance of education as we go through this very, very strange spring semester of 2020. And the folks there at Vermont PBS are stepping up to help. And Eric Ford, I'm wondering a couple things. One is, you mentioned a little bit ago that your PLUS system, I believe you said, was available for about 80 or 85% of the state.
Yeah, that's right. It's always a challenge, you know, as a statewide broadcaster. You know, we try and reach everybody wherever they're at and get our signal mm-hmm. to them. It's such a challenge. Physically, it's a small state, but there's a lot of hills, there's a lot of valleys, and we have four different broadcast channels. You know, way back, it seems like forever ago, but when we all switched to digital broadcasting and HD, you might remember that,
yep.
several years ago at this point, one of those opportunities was to create additional channels, because forever it was just everyone had the one channel, and that was how it worked, and now people have multiple channels. So we have four different channels, and one of our, what we call sub-channels, is the PLUS channel. So our regular programming there is primarily from World, which comes from WGBH, so it's a lot of documentaries and rebroadcasts of PBS primetime programs, and we program a lot of local stuff there as well. And so some folks may get it. They may not know about it. A lot of folks know about our main channel, but the PLUS channel is an HD channel, and it's available over the air for free, just like all of our four channels are. The trick there is you have to be able to get it over the air, and a lot of, you know, in Vermont, it depends on where you are. We have pretty good coverage across the state. It's, you know, most folks are covered. You might need one of those, if you can believe it, an antenna on top of your roof. It seems like an old idea, but some folks might need that in order to receive us over the air, or you may need nothing at all. You might just need to, you know, turn on your TV and scan for channels. Another way, you know, most of the way that we, you know, according to our data, the primary way that folks watch our channels is on cable. So that's mm-hmm. that's probably the largest group. Again, you have to be able to have a cable package, and you have to have a certain package to get all the channels, but that's the primary way. Unfortunately, right now, Dish, if you have Dish Network or DirecTV, any Dish service, they only carry our main channel. So that's kind of the one way that folks aren't able to get that second channel. But what we found is that, you know, for most folks, it is available. Something that's new that just started in December, actually, is a service through YouTube TV. You may have heard of this kind of, it's different than regular YouTube. It's there's other services called Sling. They're essentially live linear television over the internet, mm-hmm. which is a new thing. So it's like, instead of having to have cable, if you have internet, you could subscribe to YouTube TV. It's a monthly subscription, and you get all the local channels. So we just launched on there, so our main channel is available without cable streaming on the internet as well. So we're starting to add more and more services, but you know, our hope is that enough folks can get access to both channels so that this is valuable for them.
Now, if somebody says, boy, this is a really cool idea and I'm proud of the public TV channel for doing this, is there a special donation link or something just to support this program, or how would people make a general donation to Vermont PBS if they feel so moved?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great point. Thanks for bringing that up. We don't have a special fund, but of course we are a non-for-profit organization, which is really different than other, you know, your average television station. We're supported by the public. We're supported by members. We have grants and foundations, you know, like many other nonprofits in the state. So yeah, absolutely. Right now, you know, kind of more than ever, we do rely on folks' support. So if people find this valuable and important, you know, we absolutely would look for their support in the form of membership or donations. And you can find out all that information on our website,
All right. Well, Eric Ford from Vermont PBS, I thank you so much for joining me this morning. I wish you and the educational folks here in Vermont good luck as you launch this program and get it up and running. And we're about out of time on this segment, but thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. We're going to go to some top-of-the-hour news from CBS. We'll be talking with Elena Treen from Axios after the top of the hour, and then Mike Smith, the Human Services Secretary, will be joining me for most of the next hour. So.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
After the midpoint of the show, we'd like to bring in one of our national correspondents, and we have found a new source of folks who are able to talk to us about that broader picture of what's going on in the nation and the world, and that is the terrific online news service Axios. They very kindly are able and willing to make it available to us from time to time one of their correspondents to talk to us about what Axios.com has been reporting, and I believe we have Elena Treen on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning. I hope you're doing well.
And you too. I wanted to check in with you. One of the things I love about Axios, I get an email every morning from you all with Mike's top 10. Mike Allen, of course, was he a founding editor there? I think.
Yeah, he was one of the founders, and now our managing editor. So.
Got it. Okay, and one of the the lead item on his top 10 this morning, one big thing: warning of mass death circulated in the West Wing in January, and this was a White House official, Peter Navarro, President Trump's trade advisor, warning his White House colleagues that coronavirus could take more than 500,000 lives and cost close to $6 trillion, according to memos obtained by Axios, Jonathan Swan and Margaret Taleb. And Elena, I'm just wondering, what kind of reaction have you folks gotten to this story so far today?
Well, a lot of reaction. It's pretty amazing. I will say, you know, there's a lot of people out there who kind of doubt sometimes our reporting on these things. But we've confirmed these memos with several people in the White House. We've, of course, every time we report a massive story like this, or any story really involving the White House, we always go to their press shop and make sure that they have an opportunity to comment and respond to this. And so, yeah, it's a massive story because it does, you know, Peter Navarro, one of the president's top advisors, was warning about the massive impact of the coronavirus on the U.S. months before. Really, we've seen the big outbreak and it being labeled a pandemic here in the U.S. And a lot of people are saying, you know, if we had paid attention to these warnings earlier, perhaps the virus wouldn't have spread so quickly and been so bad as we're seeing it now.
And, you know, there's been a lot of chatter about how the president in particular and some others in his administration were basically slow on the uptake here in terms of back in January, early February, really right up until middle of March. There were a lot of steps that people now wish had been taken earlier. One defense that I keep hearing from folks on the right is that the president did order a travel restriction for people coming from China. I believe it was January 28th, and so you know that's sort of the prime example they give of, you know, quote unquote bold steps taken by this president to try to limit the outbreak. But do I have it correct that in the case of the January 28th order, it did not apply to Americans coming back from China? It was mainly geared toward Chinese nationals. Is that right?
Yes, that is right, and I will say a lot of people, especially administration officials we spoke with for this story, when the existence of these memos first came to light and started circulating within the White House, they were spread around by the National Security Council, which Peter Navarro first provided the first memo to. There was a lot of skepticism about how urgent the need for that travel ban and for other really massive measures to try and contain the outbreak were, because by then we hadn't really seen a lot of cases, or really any, I believe, in the U.S., even though they were starting to spread, obviously, throughout China and into other countries. But some people thought that Peter Navarro, he's a well-known China hawk. He's very, he's always had a very anti-China view. You see that in some of his trade policies. And so some people were worrying about what some of these measures would have on the economy, the impact on American businesses early on, before recognizing how bad the virus would be later on. And with regard to the severity of the ban, of course, you know, as you mentioned, the president did institute a ban on travel specifically from China. But there's a reason that a lot of public health experts don't lean as heavily on travel restrictions, because people come into the U.S. from a lot of places. Of course, the virus spread very quickly from other countries. And so as much as that was a decision that people praised the president for, especially, you know, when you look in the rearview mirror, that was something that a lot of people, scientists, public health experts, say that President Trump made the right call there. But it's not something, it shouldn't be shocking that it was labeled as insufficient, really, now that we look back on the administration's other maybe shortcomings, as people have said, in trying to contain this virus.
Well, yeah, and I saw a New York Times story the other day indicating that about 40,000 people had entered the country from China, even in the weeks since that January 28th travel restriction was put in place. And so I guess it took effect actually the first couple of days in February, if I remember correctly. And so pretty porous, really, as a program for, you know, stopping the spread of a disease, I would think. And I'm just wondering, do any public health officials that have come to your attention out there, are they saying that, you know, we may have sort of shaved the peak with this strategy, or is it really going to be too difficult to tell?
I think the ban definitely did contribute to helping, you know, cut back at some point. But at one point, the spread of this virus is so easy, given, you know, you can have symptoms, you could be asymptomatic to spread it. And across the country, we've seen a lot of people be very slow on the uptake to responding to these social distancing guidelines and shelter in place orders. And so it's going to be hard to tell. We're in the place now where this week and the next few weeks, depending on where you live in the country, we'll see different peaks of how bad the virus is. I think that the guidelines in place to stay home, not go out if you don't need to, trying to contain this as much as you can and stay away from people as much as possible, will only contribute to helping, you know, contain this as quick as possible. But we will continue to see the peak and the severity of this arise in the next few weeks. As I said this to you a couple weeks ago when we were on, when I joined you, and it's still true, the worst may still be yet to come, especially in places that haven't seen as much of an impact as some of the other hot spots like Washington and New York that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue here, is this is coming in waves and nobody really knows exactly where next. I think that's one of the difficulties, one of the sort of anxiety invoking uncertainties here. One thing that, you know, I do wonder whether the coronavirus response by the federal government will, you know, within the next month or two, start to really seem more streamlined. I mean, are they getting it together over time, or is it still going to feel like it's a bit of a shakedown cruise?
I think that, especially given the spikes that we've seen in the last few weeks and the numbers of people dying in this country rising so rapidly, the way that people are responding to this has been much more, respectable to the guidelines put in place than they were in a few weeks ago. But we're still seeing people ignore some of these guidelines, and I think particularly in places that haven't really seen the impact hit them as hard as some of the cities like New York that have been kind of paralyzed by the virus. But I do think that the president, a big And a lot of people said, you know, kudos to him for extending the guidelines, the federal guidelines, from he originally hoped that the economy and people would be going back to work by this Sunday on Easter. He extended those guidelines by the recommendation of several public health officials and scientists across the country. And so hopefully people are looking to that as a signal to stay home and stay indoors. Now, of course, those federal guidelines don't necessarily they're not mandatory, and it's really up to governors in the states to make these decisions. And so we've seen a lot of governors, you know, someone like Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, others in Mississippi and Alabama, being much slower to respond in the way that the White House and the federal government has and other governors. And so I think that it's going to continue to be an uphill battle in many states where people just aren't taking this as seriously as they need to.
All right. Well, Elena Treen from Axios, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. Stay safe.
All righty. Stay healthy. My next guest is Vermont's Secretary of Human Services. The Human Services Agency, of course, the largest in state government and has a big portfolio, including everything from the state's prisons, of course, to the Child Welfare Agency, Department for Children and Families, the Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, which oversees our nursing homes, a huge issue right now with the coronavirus outbreaks we're seeing. And I really appreciate Mike Smith joining me this morning. Of course, I note he's a former host of this very two-hour talk block on WDEV, then called Open Mic, now called The Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Mike Smith, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you very much, David, and I apologize. I'm doing a radio no-no. I'm calling in on a cell phone, and as you know, we'd like to do landlines in the radio business.
Well, best of all is in the studio face-to-face, but we're not doing that these days, so we are being as forgiving as possible, and Mike, your willingness and ability to give us a half hour here on the Dave Graham Show, I know it's just been crazy busy for all of you top state officials. I hope you guys are getting sufficient sleep and some decent food and keeping up your immune systems, because God knows we don't want you, any of you folks, to catch the coronavirus. And folks in leadership are not immune. Look at our friend Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister. He's in an intensive care today with it, and so we're all pulling for him. But, Mike, I wanted to check in with you because you do have oversight now over this State Agency of Human Services and all of its subsidiary departments, and so many of them are work with Vermont's most vulnerable citizens. And you clearly have a mission that is critical in normal times and is just hypercritical at this point, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you named some of it, from health to the health department.
That's right, the health department. They've been sort of like leadoff hitter here, so, yeah.
That's right. To corrections, to the Department of Mental Health, to DEVA for Medicaid, and those sort of programs. For DCF, like you talked about, and I'm sure I'm missing. I have six, so I'm sure I'm missing some here as I talk. But, you know, quite an expansive agency, 3,600 employees, $2.6 billion budget. So quite expansive, and I couldn't be prouder of the agency right now. It's stepping up and doing everything possible to protect Vermonters and making sure that the vulnerable are taken care of to the extent possible during this crisis. As you know, this is unprecedented. None of us have seen it in our lifetime, unless, David, you're much older than me, and I don't think you are.
Nope.
I think I am the older one here, so I haven't.
We're pretty close to contemporaries, I think, Mike, but that's okay, whatever.
I think, we haven't seen this since the early 20th century, and even then, I don't know how that compares to now, but certainly these are times that we've never seen before.
And let's go to some sort of breaking news here. I saw a Digger story this morning, vtdigger.org, talking about a couple staffers testing positive up at the Northwest State Correctional Facility in Swanton, and they put the facility on lockdown. Tell us, first off, how does a lockdown help in this? Is it just a matter of keeping people from moving around?
It's keeping people from moving around. It's delivering meals to the cells. It's making sure that we don't have movement, or if we do have movement, it's done in a controlled fashion with small groups that are out there. We've had two staff members that are tested positive. The first staff member actually left the facility March 26 and was tested negative, and then subsequently did not come back to the facility because he wasn't feeling well, and then later on checked himself into Plattsburgh, or he was taken to Plattsburgh, where he lives, I think, and they were going through the testing there because he was on respiratory distress, so they were testing him there. So he had not been in the facility since March 26. He had not tested positive after that date, but subsequently perhaps became positive after that date. Then the other one has tested positive, had been in the facility April 2nd, I believe, was the last time they were in the facility. So we're taking extra precautions up there and instituting what is called a lockdown procedure and making sure that we limit movement, make sure that we deliver meals, and that any sort of movement in that facility is done in small groups. So it's a precaution as we move forward. So far, there's been no inmates who have tested positive for the coronavirus, but we're very diligent in trying to make sure and protect our inmate population.
Now, how long do you expect a lockdown at that facility will remain in effect?
We'll try to keep it in effect until we sort of get the all clear in terms of the CDC guidance. In terms of how long it should take, I think it's 72 hours since the last time of exposure, but it could go on a little bit further than that. We'll determine day by day, David, on what we're doing up to that facility as well as we're doing in other facilities. Now, I do want the listeners to know we have pretty much limited access to facilities. To the correctional facilities. Visitation rights have been done by video now rather than person to person. We do take temperature checks of staff on a daily basis. We also have supplies that are delivered in advance in sort of keeping up. That doesn't mean we don't have shortage of some supplies. For example, hand sanitizer and those sort of things. But, there is soap, which is, as the CDC says, is just as effective. So we are implementing various precautions, including masking, as the CDC updates its guidance there. But, this is a situation where we've never faced before, where a virus doesn't have walls. We've seen it in our long-term care facilities where the most vulnerable, the people that are over 65 are the most vulnerable to this virus. This virus, you can't build walls against it, and it's something that we just really have to be vigilant in terms of trying to protect at least not only our prison population but our most vulnerable out there.
Now, you had a report of a positive test in a staffer at the Northern State facility in Newport a week or two. When was that? Do you remember the date?
Yeah. I got to tell you, the days are like dog days here. I can't remember the date. It seems like forever. But that was either a week or two ago that we had a staffer up in the Newport. Now, that staffer didn't have direct access to the secured location of the correctional facility, but nonetheless we tested that person. That person was removed, the area was scrubbed, and we are, so far, you know, knock on wood, we've been lucky in our correctional facilities.
Yeah, and let's turn our attention now to Vermont's nursing homes, because we have not been as lucky there. And what can or should nursing homes and long-term care facilities do to try to limit the spread of coronavirus in those facilities? Clearly, they seem, I don't want to say, well, maybe prone is the right word, but certainly vulnerable.
Yeah, and we knew that early on, just looking at the experience in Washington State. And as you remember, I think it was mid-March that we issued our first executive order. The governor issued his first executive order, and we took the unprecedented step of basically curtailing visitation rights at nursing homes. I know that was a controversial step. It was for those families who had people within their nursing homes or other long-term living facilities. That was a it was hard for them to take that sort of thing. Their loved ones are there; they can't see them. So we took the unprecedented step of curtailing visitation rights to those facilities. We also have started upping our game in terms of guidance, in terms of inspections, in terms of making sure that they have PPE in their facilities. Just last week, we went to all the facilities in the state. I think there were 34 nursing homes and 14 residential care facilities that we went to. I may not have those exact numbers right, but they're in that facility, in that sort of area in terms of numbers, where we went and asked them. We looked at what they're doing for prevention. We looked at what their needs are for PPE. We looked at to give them guidance on what they're doing. The other thing that we've done also, in those places where there's outbreaks in what I would call not long-term care facilities, but in home sort of environments, like apartments for seniors and stuff like that, we added on another layer where we have DPS and others, including the Agency of Human Services, delivering supplies to those people that have been sort of quarantined within that facility. So there is a lot of things happening in senior care facilities. But as you look across the country, that's where people are most vulnerable right now, is in those long-term care facilities.
Is one of the reasons that death rates there tended to be higher that many of the residents, especially up in their 80s and 90s and so on, have advanced directives talking about with do not resuscitate orders, and so they are not a person in that category would not be placed on a ventilator, for instance, if taken to the hospital, right?
That's right. There's many in that age group that have do not resuscitate, do not do not transport, do not ventilate, basically, in terms of what is going on with their advanced directives. So their care plan that they have chosen does not allow for, in some cases, even the transport of people.
Okay. I have another question about that, but we've got to go to our bottom of the hour news break for some CBS News and a couple of words from our sponsors. Mike Smith is my guest. He's the Vermont's Secretary of Human Services, and he's promised to stay with us for another quarter hour after the break, so appreciate that, and we'll be back. Perhaps if a couple of listeners want to call in, they can check in at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. More of the Dave Graham Show after the break. Stay with us, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Mike Smith is my guest. He is Vermont's Secretary of Human Services. And, Mike, we were talking a little bit before about do not resuscitate orders and about how some of the folks who have passed in our nursing homes recently of the coronavirus and its related symptoms have basically not been transported for treatment at hospitals. One thing I'm wondering about those people who are transported for treatment let's focus for a moment, I'm sorry, on the folks who are not transported or anybody who is basically in their final hours here. I mean, the idea of acute respiratory distress syndrome just sounds horrible, frankly. You're essentially drowning, I guess, in fluids building up in your lungs. And I'm wondering, is there any sort of palliative treatment here? Are people given morphine, or are they helped just to minimize the discomfort over those last hours?
Yeah, I would defer to Dr. Levine, the Commissioner of Health, on sort of those sort of what has happened. I would imagine that any caregiver is going to make sure that those people that are in that situation are in the most comfortable situation as possible. And as I want to emphasize, as possible. But in terms of the actual procedures, David, I just don't know.
Yeah, that's I guess that's more of a medical question. I also wondered your sense of obviously the biggest question really in the last couple of weeks, and I'm just curious to know, get refreshed on what you're hearing in your briefings and so on, and also your own thoughts about this, and that is. I was just looking at another Digger story about big shipments of a PPE and so on, and we'll talk about that in more detail in a minute. But coming into the state of Vermont, Vermont's healthcare system in general, is it ready for this? Are we going to have a peak that is closely matched to the ability of our hospitals to maybe overflow facilities to handle it? Are we going to be ready?
Here's what we're trying to do. And if you go back to mid-March and the governor talking about this, what we can't happen is all of a sudden have a surge that goes to the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario we have sort of mapped out in various models that we've done and actually shared those models with the public. We can't have that happen, or else we could sort of max out our healthcare capacity. We are obviously planning for the worst case scenario, but right now, encouragingly, the predictive models that we have are showing us trending in a better position than the worst case scenario. Actually, I think the reason we're doing all this social distancing, the reason why we're putting all these measures, and they're measures that are unprecedented, and I know Vermonters are suffering out there and struggling out there, but the reason we're putting all these measures into place is to make sure we don't max out our healthcare system as has happened in other countries, particularly Italy, what you may see in New York City, although there seems to be some abatement that's going on in New York City. We're trying to make sure that we don't. Right now, I can say, as we look at the models, I'm feeling fairly confident if the models hold up the way that the predictive models are going, that we can make sure that we don't max out the healthcare capacity that we have out there. But it is critically important that people keep up with the stay home, stay safe, social distancing, masking, all the things that the governor has put in place, because the modeling can turn on a dime if we let up on those sort of things. So the answer is I'm cautiously optimistic, given what I'm seeing so far. But that is something we just have to look day to day on.
Oh, I have an email from a listener who had a question. I think following on our conversation about the lockdown at the prison in Swanton, and the question is: are corrections officers and other prison staff now wearing masks during the workday?
My understanding is they're being masked as we speak.
Okay, so that wasn't happening before, but it is going forward from now?
Yep.
I see. What's your sense of sort of timing here? I mean, I've seen projections. I gather late April, early May is sort of when I've been sort of using this metaphor of a wave crashing into a seawall here. But is that when that actual the water hits the concrete, so to speak?
I think in the next few weeks we're going to see the peak in Vermont. I can't give you a precise date, but it's within this two-week period that we're talking about, and could extend to the latter part of April as we're looking. Our modeling is showing that we're entering sort of this phase where we will see it getting worse before it gets better, and it will peak at some point in right around the next few weeks here as we move forward. You know, somebody asked me the other day, well, when can we let up? I can't answer that question, because I think it would be irresponsible of me to do that until we can see some data that gives us some opportunity to say that we're past the peak, we're on the downside of the peak. That data is not there yet.
Well, I wanted to ask, another way to approach that, obviously I don't think anybody has a date in mind yet, but about criteria for making the decision. In other words, do coronavirus cases have to get back to zero in Vermont before, the governor gives the all clear and then we can all go back to our normal lives? Or do they have to get back to some level above zero? And what are the criteria here for saying that we've beaten this thing?
Yeah, I think we're developing those right now. But one of the things that I will say about this, you won't see us flip a switch off. You won't see, as we sort of, entered into this in phases and, started out in mid-March with sort of the executive orders that started into the stay home, stay safe executive order. You'll see us start to phase this down in various steps as we move forward. But we're not there yet terms of turning that switch. But you'll see it in phases as we start going down. It's not going to be, like I just said, it's not going to be a flip switch off and everything's back to normal. It's going to be phased down as we move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that if and when we ever do get a sort of an all clear announcement, people in Vermont, and this will be happening everywhere, I do believe, will basically be wanting to have some cross between, Grace Potter's annual festival on the Burlington waterfront and the Montpelier 3rd of July parade, and will be in a mood for a party, I don't know if that ever will sort of be able to happen.
We kind of have to be careful, because we have to make sure that this doesn't rebound on us.
We're going to have to be careful
as we start winding down on this thing. But I want to be also cautious here, David. I don't want people to take their eye off the ball here. It's still important as if we enter these next few weeks that we continue the social distancing sort of protocol that we're on right now, that we continue to stay home, stay safe, that we continue all the aspects of washing your hands, multiple times a day, and that we wear masks when we're in public. That is all critical right now in order to get to that point we were just talking about, because we're not there yet.
I probably shouldn't even mention it, because I don't want to get anybody's hopes up for anything immediate. But hey, we just got you for a couple more minutes, Mike Smith, and I do have a caller on the line. I believe it's Michael in Barrytown. Good morning.
Waitsfield.
Sorry about that.
Right.
I remember Michael from Waitsfield. Go ahead.
You do. A question for me. I have a mother-in-law that's in a nursing home, and I've spent plenty of time there, and I see it's a very easy place to be, you know, for infection to run rampant. But I've been doing a lot of reading about this recently, and I've been reading about the situation with the bleaches that they use as a disinfectant, every brand, like, you know, I don't know if it's Clorox or Lysol or any brand that they use. They're only effective when you wipe it down. As soon as it dries, you're starting over again. So when the person comes and they use these disinfections, they wipe it down, it actually kills the bugs. The second that it's dried, it becomes completely ineffective, and you're waiting for a new rebuild. It's a good thing, but it's limited. But I also understand that you can't use them around food areas, like in kitchens and stuff like that, because the bleach is toxic. And Chipotle, I was reading about Chipotle, they found a product that has a 24-hour residual effect, and it can be used around food, FDA approved, by a company called Pure Bioscience, I think is the name of the company. And boy, that really intrigued me. Here's a product that you put on that it can be in food contact, and it has a 24-hour residual. Have you ever heard of that one?
I have not, Michael, and I will leave it to the microbiologist to figure out if that has some validity. I will tell you this. There's been a lot of people who have claimed a lot of things during this virus. 50 to 70% of them seem to be untrue.
But wait a minute. I have to interrupt, because this is FDA approved.
Well, then we'll take a look at it. We'll take a look at it as we move forward.
Michael,
thank you.
Michael, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And Mike Smith, I thank you very much for joining me today. I know we promised to let you go about 45 after the hour, and we are here. So thank you so much, sir, for joining me this morning. Let's talk again soon.
David, let's try to make it happen. I hope we all get back to normal at some point here, and we can start seeing each other face to face. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Stay healthy, okay, Mike Smith. Let's go to a caller. I think we have Fred on from East Montpelier. Good morning, Fred.
This is Fred from Newberry.
I'm sorry, Fred from Newberry. There we go.
Does Vermont have enough personal protective equipment for the healthcare workers? Do you know that?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Does Vermont have enough personal protective equipment for healthcare workers?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, I was just looking at a story in VT Digger about that, and there's some discussion about quite a bit of this gear coming into the state in just the last few days, and that it looks like if the projections hold for sort of how high the wave is going to get, how many cases in Vermont, that Vermont should be okay in this regard. And there's always a chance here, too, because it's so hard to predict, that we could end up with extra stuff. And then that question was asked, I think, at the governor's news conference yesterday by one of the reporters. And I think at that point, this coronavirus is going to hit different parts of the country and sort of hit the maximum upward curve or whatever in those locations at different times. And so I think what you may see, I mean, this is a wild guess. Don't hold me to this, folks, but I wouldn't be surprised if the projections hold true that it peaks in late April or early May in Vermont. You'll see our supplies of this stuff, the personal protective equipment, etc., depleted significantly. But if it gets to July and we decide we are basically, pretty much over this thing, and it's increasing in, I don't know, Kansas or Nebraska or something, maybe we ship some if we have extra supplies, maybe we ship them to Kansas or Nebraska. So I think there's a real sense of uncertainty surrounding every aspect of this pandemic, and one of them is, will we have enough supplies? The hope right now is the answer is yes. That's all I can tell you.
I'm wondering if they can figure out a way that they could store supplies and then have a reserve. And as the medical market needs supplies, they could take it out of it but always replace it, so they could have a reserve if we had a pandemic like this. Or would that be just too expensive?
I think that's the big question right now is, can the health system, assuming that as a lot of public health officials believe, won't be the last pandemic we will see in the coming years or decades or whatever, we may have to really tool up the health care system with a new ability to, you know, suddenly kind of expand its ability to respond to something like this. We were caught flat-footed, I'd say, this time. Can't be caught flat-footed again. So, Fred, I got to take another call before we round out the show, but thank you for checking in. We'll talk soon. Hey, let's go to Renee in East Montpelier. Good morning, Renee.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the program. I have two thoughts that I've had that I've seen from international sources, but definitely seen nothing in Vermont, and that is that there's such a limited number of testing, and a lot of Vermonters were really ill in January and early February before we even heard of COVID, but we're not getting any tests here in Vermont to see if we have the antibodies in our immune systems. And also, the countries who were able to manage the COVID, they were testing everybody, not only people with symptoms. So it's great that we're starting to wear masks and everything, but what can the Scott administration do? Or maybe it's time that our media talked about it so that the Scott administration would take leadership in pressuring the national government to make available more tests and to commandeer that these tests are made. How can we upgrade? How can Vermont take leadership in helping us to get what other international countries have been using with some success, both and for other epidemics, which, you know, like globally, this is what people have been saying, is that with global climate change, there are going to be more and more of these mutated viruses and diseases coming down the pike.
Yeah. Well, Renee, I think it's a really good question. I think I'm going to put it on my list of topics to try to dig into in the next in the coming days here on the Dave Graham Show.
Cool. Can I give you one more real quick?
And sure.
That is that Cuba and China and one other country that I'm not remembering right now that actually have antidotes and treatments that are working. We have a national leadership who, instead of embracing these biomedical technologies that can take care of our public, are alienating them. And I'd like to hear, I mean, Vermont is known as a national leader. I'd love to hear the Vermont media and Vermont leadership talking about these things.
Renee, I think you raised some really good points. Unfortunately, I'm about out of time.
Thank you,
I really appreciate your call. I'll try to keep these things in mind. That's going to be about it for the Dave Graham Show on this Tuesday morning, and I appreciate all the listeners out there. And tune in again tomorrow. In the meantime, stay tuned. Today, we are going to offer up Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio at 11 o'clock. So stay with WDEV, folks. More coverage to come. Have a good day, everybody. Stay healthy.